number 8 and 9, the secondary plan, and well, both secondary plans. And before we start, we're going to have a brief presentation by the administration on the Cordon Osborne Area Plan.
Go ahead. My name is Curtis Kowalki, Senior Planner with the City's Urban Planning Division. For the benefit of the committee today and for the benefit of those in the gallery, we thought we'd take a few minutes to run through some of the key aspects of this plan. It's been many years in the making, and there's a lot of content there. And hopefully we can help establish a cursory understanding of the different aspects. So the area plan outlines a strategy to advance our Winnipeg and Complete Communities Direction strategy in order to accomplish the following outcomes. Transit-oriented development around the Osborne Rapid Transit Station, improvement of the streetscapes and connections for an enhanced commercial area and circulation throughout the plan area, and preservation of the character of the community. First, I'll talk a bit about the public realm. The plan recommends, as illustrated in this conceptual drawing, better pedestrian access to the Red and the Assiniboine Rivers, additional trailways, expansion of plaza spaces and park spaces, enhanced streetscapes, and better connectivity to the Osborne Station, and a reimagining of Pembina Highway as a gateway into this area, into Osborne Village and into Cordon and Osborne, with better sidewalks and with bikeways. Next, I'll talk a bit about this master plan illustration. This drawing illustrates in the different colors how this whole plan is organized. Each of these colored areas has its own policies and its own design recommendations. And I'll quickly just touch on each of these to give an overview. First, I'll talk about this area in pink on the right-hand side. This is the high-rise mixed-use area. It has the closest proximity to the rapid transit station and therefore allows and encourages the greatest densities. This illustration is sort of an example of what that might look like. This particular sketch is intended to be a view of Pembina Highway. You can see in the sketch examples of an enhanced greener streetscape. And these are improvements suggested to Pembina Highway to really help encourage and facilitate the development of Pembina Highway as a high-density residential community. You can see on the very left side of the slide the idea of some additional green space close to the rapid transit station. Pembina Highway and this particular location is also envisioned as a future potential site for a partnership with the developer to increase the amount of public parking in the area through a structure either included in one of these buildings or attached to one of these buildings. Next, we'll look at the medium-rise mixed-use areas in yellow and the striped areas as well in yellow. These areas represent, in particular the one on the right-hand side, represents a transition between the high-rise high-density area along Pembina and along Donald, and the lower-rise, low-density residential established neighborhood further to the west. I've also got on the left side here, you'll see sort of a one-block segment near the corner of Stafford and Cordon, and this area is also seen as a sort of a gateway into the neighborhood from the west side, and is therefore also tagged as medium-rise mixed use. And here's an example in the illustration of what that might look like. This, for example, could be Cordon Avenue at either the easternmost two blocks or the westernmost block. Next, I'll mention the low-rise mixed-use areas. The vision for these areas is that of a traditional urban village. It represents the central blocks of the Cordon Commercial Strip, as well as sections of Lilac Street and Grosvenor Avenue. For Lilac and Grosvenor, the intent is for additional commercial development where it's contiguous to the existing commercial nodes along those two streets. The plan recommends effectively a status quo in terms of building heights in this area, in the 2 to 4 story range, the same as what the zoning currently supports. And here's an example of what that might look like. Buildings in the 2 to 4 story range, commercial ideally at grade, residential above. Now I'll talk a bit about the residential areas of the plan. North of Porton, you'll see sort of three main color segments on this map. Along Wellington Crescent on the north side of the street, this is tagged as residential towers, and that effectively represents or reflects what's the predominant character of that area. And below, south of that, you've got sort of the dark brown and the pale green areas. These are tagged as medium density and higher density residential zones within the plan area. And what that means is something like this. This red building, for example, in this drawing, would be a site mid-block that's of a very small scale. It could be a multifamily, but done in a way that fits the neighborhood in terms of scales, setbacks, and densities. So then the last area I'll cover is the residential areas south of Cordon Avenue. In the pale yellow, this is tagged as the lower density residential area. It's intended primarily for single detached dwellings and duplex, two-family dwellings, with opportunities for small-scale multifamily, 3 to 4 units typically on corner lots. And this building on the left-hand side, for example, would be a double-wide lot with potentially 3 or 4 units. Intended to sort of fit into the scale of the existing dwellings on that street. And while I'm on this slide, I'll touch on another element of the plan, which is the design standards. The design standards is one of the key underpinnings of this secondary plan. The premise is that within the plan area generally, there's an expectation to be able to accommodate growth and infill, especially growth and infill suited to a neighborhood that's transit-oriented. That has to be done in a way that preserves and enhances the traditional character of this area. So the consultant has proposed a rigorous set of design standards for each of those policy areas that we just looked at. An example of what those design standards entail would be, for example, that the proportion, scale, and facade elements in adjacent buildings should be reflected in new buildings. And so while this building in green it is effectively one building, potentially with 4 units, it reads as almost 2 separate smaller buildings. And that's really important, that new development fit the character and style and the rhythm of that street, of those lower density streets south of Cordon. So I'll talk a little bit about how this plan is intended to be implemented. There's a number of short-term and long-term actions that are mentioned in the fourth part of this secondary plan. I'll touch on zoning a little bit. And just to clarify, there may have been a bit of misunderstanding. No zoning is being changed today. There's no zoning application as part of this public hearing. The plan merely provides guidance and direction on new applications that come forward. However, as an implementation action, the Winnipeg Public Service will be bringing forward a number of proposed amendments should this plan be adopted at Council in the coming weeks. The intent would be to extend and reinforce the existing protection that's in the current PDO. There's currently a plan development zoning overlay on a portion of Osborne and a portion of Cordon Avenue. And the idea would be to extend those protections to all the mixed-use areas in the plan. An example of those protections include the use-specific standards, which reduce or limit the types of commercial development to a slightly smaller scale. In other words, you won't see a Rona or a large format supermarket on Cordon Avenue. The use-specific standards limit it to a fine-grained, smaller scale form of development. And that was a fairly recent adjustment to this plan based on the feedback that we heard at the public open house. The next item is to make two-family development easier to build by right. In the past number of years, many duplex developments have been supported by this committee. None have been rejected. And the intent is to help streamline that system to facilitate development in this neighborhood. Which brings me to the next point. In order to do that, a new plan development overlay would make design review mandatory for all development other than single family. And the intent of this is to make sure that, as I showed you in the illustrations earlier, that while on one hand we're making development a little more streamlined and easier to achieve, we're also making sure that it achieves the objectives of the plan from a design perspective. So this is a separate bullet item because not only would there be a change in the zoning that makes design review mandatory, the consultant also recommended that we take those design recommendations even further. There's several pages of recommendations in the plan document for you. And those would certainly serve the public service and the community in the interim as new development comes forward. As we make development easier, especially for small-scale, two-family-type dwellings, we would also, the consultant has suggested that we take a closer look at those design standards, perhaps produce a design guidelines document or embed specific design controls right in the zoning bylaw. That would be an exercise we obviously undertake with neighborhood stakeholders. Now for some long-term actions, and I've touched on some of these earlier, so I'll keep this really brief. We talked about better pedestrian access to the rivers. This might occur as new development in that area occurs, and there's an opportunity to get an easement or to acquire a pathway. The Pembina Highway enhancements I talked about in order to help facilitate and encourage a higher density residential community. More public parking options, and more public open space. So just to summarize, this plan is based on flexibility. It's not a rigid plan. It's designed in a way that if there are unique circumstances that come forward, it's possible through the rezoning process, through this committee, to achieve slightly different outcomes than a specific number of units or a specific number of feet in height. The plan is intended to support infilling growth. And in fact, the consultant has done a detailed calculation on all the opportunities within each of those colored areas I talked about. And they've estimated that the plan, as written, can accommodate 1.7 million square feet of additional commercial space and 4,500 to 8,700 new dwelling units, much of that being, of course, targeted to our regional corridors and the rapid transit station area. Which is a tremendous number and actually far exceeds what Conference Board of Canada projections suggest is likely over the next 30 years in this neighborhood. This plan has been tailored to community expectations, and I already mentioned that the plan that was presented at the Open House has been tweaked somewhat to incorporate suggestions that were received from the community, the example, of course, being the size of commercial development within the plan development overlay. We've had many consultation opportunities. I feel like we've had excellent feedback. Some of the key themes that we've heard at many of these sessions and through the surveys is the importance of design, and you see that reflected in the plan. The importance of neighborhood character, of the historical elements that are within the plan area. People want to see a more bike-friendly community. They want to see landscaping incorporated, and they want to see trees preserved and incorporated. The last thing I'll point out before I wrap up and go to questions is that you'll see also in the recommendation for you today a short list of amendments recommended. Since first reading in September, we've had a couple months to test the plan against current applications we've been receiving on sort of a what-if basis. Through that exercise, we've identified those amendments. Most of them are wording changes aimed at better clarity and accuracy. A few of them are minor corrections, such as a boundary discrepancy on a couple of the maps. Another small correction you'll note is that it relates to auto-related uses, in other words, gas stations and auto body shops. The plan intended to prohibit those, but I don't think it was intended to make all of Pembina highly non-conforming. If you've driven down Pembina, you know that there's a lot of auto sales centers and tire centers and a car wash on Donald. You'll see a slight rewording of the language in today's proposed amendments that are a little more strict on Corridon, but on Pembina provide somewhat softer language, using the term discourage instead of prohibit. With that, I'll open it up to any questions.
Thank you very much. Anybody have any questions? Councilor Gibanasi?
Well, I think I'll wait and hear what any delegations might say. I've been discussing it at length with the planning department myself already. At this point, I'll hold off.
Okay. Well, I guess, no, he's not the, is the city the applicant? Is a public hearing?
Yes.
So they'll come back?
I'll sit down.
Yeah, they can come back.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Also in support would be, if you'd like to come up, you don't have to, it's your turn to speak if you like, Lanny Silver. You're fine? Okay. And now, in opposition, first of all, anybody else in support of the application that I haven't called? Going once, going twice, moving on. We have Earl Martin, if you'd like to come up and speak in opposition to the proposal. You don't have to, you can just voice your concerns, unless you have to speak. Come on up. Welcome. So you got about 10 minutes. Just give us your name and your address. And do you want to set up the computer? You don't have to, but do you have something visual for us? Or
I could.
You don't have to. Just offering.
I don't know.
Good to go? Okay, go right ahead.
Okay. Overall, I like the plan. My only issue is the restrictions on height. Okay. I don't consider height a bad thing when it's done right. So this is 240 Stradbroke. I consider this bad design because it's basically, this is a wall. Each floor plate has like 14 or more suites. The developer could have done the exact same thing with six or eight suites per floor and gone even taller and ended up with something more like this, like the Vancouverism model, which I love, like, you know, townhouses or retail, and then a tower that could be even much taller than that, and but tall and slender. I think tall and slender is awesome.
Fair enough.
And so I'm not sure how strict the restrictions are on the medium density and high density for height, but. If you guys could really push the tall and slender, I think that makes a desirable community. It's been proven, certainly in Vancouver and anywhere else that has adopted it. And so I don't know if it's too late, but
well, we'll ask.
I wanted to...
Yeah, we can ask for you when it comes up. But administration will come back. We can ask that question for you.
Yeah.
Anything else?
No.
That's good. All right. Thank you very much. Anybody else not in support of, in opposition of the application? Seeing no one, going once, going twice, moving on. Now, this next session, if you have questions, you have to come up and ask a question. You can ask, I guess, and then we ask for you, or how does that work?
Well, it's for information, but yeah. They can come up if they want, or they can.
Yeah, so for information, we have Tim. Put him on the back of the pot. Kendra, you okay? Jonathan, put your brake behind him. Shirley, come on up.
Hello, welcome back. reached the end, finally.
There you are. Just name and address for the record, and off we go.
Shirley Forsyth, address 644 Warsaw Avenue, and I brought sort of the timelines along, probably.
Okay. Thank you.
No, but anyway, I came to the first meeting in May of 2011. I've been to everyone since, and it's kind of nice to know it's over.
Almost.
Okay, it's never going to really be over, but yeah, we're through this part. Okay, I have some questions. And it's just, obviously I've read the plan a couple of times. I don't actually know whether all these years I've put in have made any difference at all, but it's what we have. Now, it says that it's going to be evaluated, and then it'll be reviewed in 5 years' time. That's what it says at the back of the plan. It says that the city will be doing this, but there's no mention of any input from community groups. So I think it's important that the community be involved in that. In one point, it says the finished floor level should be the average of the adjacent buildings. I know that there were concerns about visitable housing and having housing that people could enter, and that never came up in the plan.
I believe that's dealt with in one of the amendments.
In one of the amendments.
The problems addressed.
Okay. Just picking little things.
Go ahead.
When we did have the meeting with the community, there was a lot of concern about increased traffic in the back lanes, and there was a picture, and people reacted quite strongly to that. Now, it says use design controls to encourage walkway connections to rear parking in Cordon Avenue, and then there's to be a setback in back lanes onto Cordon Avenue, which seems to me would be resulting in the same thing, right? Increased traffic in the back lane and parking. So that's a concern. And we have a lot of parking problems in our neighborhood, and I think just the business and the residents all agree on that. And it says 3.6.21 parking relaxations. Parking requirements should be relaxed on future infield development and redevelopment with consideration for implementation of a payment in lieu system. And I think if they do that, that's only increase parking problems with new development and new. So that's a problem, although I suppose apparently from CBC it does result in quite a bit of revenue for the city when it comes to parking tickets. Yeah. But it's not good for the neighborhood. And this, I think, is my last one. Or two more. Widening sidewalks. In all the renderings in the plan, there's no bike paths when it comes to the streets. And I know that there used to be enough space to bike along the sidewalk on Osborne, but when they widened the sidewalk, South Osborne, no more bike path. So I think if they're going to talk about widening the sidewalks, they have to take into consideration where the bikes are going to go, because some of the streets are already dangerous enough. So there needs to be bike paths, and they need to think about that, hopefully. And that's my last point.
Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you very much. Tim, please come up. Questions?
Hello. My name is Tim Colmack. I'm both a resident and a developer in the area, as well as represents a large landowner in and around the area. First and foremost, it needs to be said that this is a great process, and the plan itself, the intent, we believe in it strongly. We've just got a few concerns and a few thoughts that we wanted to share so they could be considered, because on a weekly, monthly, annual basis, we're dealing with the city, and we can identify from our side of the fence some of the things within here that we wanted to at least put forth for consideration. Our primary concern, our primary motivation for being here is because our main objective is to develop market affordable housing. Our target demographic is young professionals, millennials, and the boomers, both of which they have a glass ceiling as to what they're willing to pay. And we do see some items within here that do net up the cost of construction for the buildings that would be proposed within each one of those zones compared to suburban greenfield development. And so what's ultimately happening, in our personal opinion, is that it's creating an environment where infill development cost per square foot is ultimately higher than developing in suburbia. Our first point was through the process we felt that one stakeholder wasn't considered, and that was the consumer. Although the plan was brought forward to the community, I do believe that these two jewels in our city, both Osborne and Cordon, are enjoyed by the city at large. And so we wanted to ask if maybe the city would contemplate some sort of focus group setting to put these policies, plans, and initiatives forward to a cross-section that represents the general city of Winnipeg populace. We think that'd be a great way to also kind of technically do a consumer analysis for the people that we'd ultimately be selling to. Moving on through the plan, there's a few policies that we'd like to quickly touch on. Page 22, policy 3.2, the vision development. We found that the may, the should, and the shall, as defined in the plan, does help people understand where the flexibility is and where it is not. We'd like to suggest that, if possible, the planning department puts together some form of meat chart that very clearly identifies the items within the policies that must be adhered to, the items that have some level of flexibility, and the items that are just simple recommendations. I think that would make it a lot easier for anyone coming to these two areas to develop, to interpret and understand it, and being a younger person developing, it would have helped us a lot in the last number of years. It also helps people assess the value of a site, and so it's quite fair from the perspective of both the seller to understand the value of their site, as well as the buyer to understand what they're actually getting. And I'll touch on some of these items as we move through. Policy 3.5.11, mid-rise mixed uses, where they identify a building height of 2 to 6 stories. From our perspective, once you move past 4 floors, you're now moving into non-combustible construction. And in that vein, you're permitted up to 8 floors within a certain fire rating. And we suggest that wherever you've stated 6 floors, that you possibly alter that to read to 8 floors, because otherwise the cost of the non-combustible construction for the additional 2 floors can only be broken out across the 6 floors instead of the 8 floors, again netting up the cost of construction. Whereas in suburbia, if you wanted to do 8 floors of concrete construction, you'd be empowered to spread that cost across a larger volume of suites and ultimately a larger area of building. When you couple that with some other policies like stepping back and 90% of site coverage, et cetera, you continue to do the same thing, but I'll touch on that as I move along. The page 40, policy 3.5.50, elevated building setbacks, it states in here that taller buildings and mixed-use areas should step back upper stories from commercial street facades at least 1 story in depth and an interval of minimum 3 stories. I understand the intent. I actually kind of agree from the perspective of, you know, maybe the first floor or second floor. I don't believe that you need to step back continually. In my personal opinion, I'd like to express to you that when we've costed out stepping a building back, there are some additional costs that are immediately inherent to that. And I wanted to put on record that the immediate cost is the mobilization and setup of whoever's building upwards, insulation of windows, all types of building cladding materials, etc. And so it has the effect of ultimately netting up the cost of construction. We'd suggest that possibly consider some flexibility where if someone's stepping back enough, that stepping back once after the commercial grade be considered. Again, stepping back isn't something that's necessarily required in greenfield sites. Policy 3.5.51 on page 40, the elevated views. Residential buildings should minimize the intrusion of elevated viewing spaces overlooking private recreational outdoor spaces. I understand it. Nobody wants someone staring down into their rear yard. But in the end, although it does say should, we're either for condo development or we're not. There are some people that will result possibly in being negatively impacted. In our personal opinion, we should be very certain that each unit should always be permitted to have a balcony. Policy 3.5.52 states here that roof lines should reflect surrounding context and be energy efficient. I believe that should relate to National Building Code, and I'd just like someone to specify. Roof gardens should be encouraged on low-rise and mid-rise buildings only within this policy. We're asking why not on high-rise. We're also wondering if people can contemplate that although people like these public spaces, they're highly unused. In our review of doing multiple developments and analyzing what consumers want, because of the Winnipeg weather, it really only gives you 3+ months to really enjoy it, and a lot of people at the lake during that time of the year. So I want to go on record and just state again that roof gardens, they're very expensive. We've analyzed doing them in multiple scenarios. You have to extend the elevator shaft, which comes with a whole inherent series of additional items that you have to extend, like the stairwells. You have to increase the structural capacity. The roofing materials change underneath the active space, the railing, the decking, the plantings, etc., and the insurance for Condo Corp goes up. Like I had said, roof gardens in Winnipeg tend to be rarely utilized, so in our opinion, we don't really see it as something that we would want to necessarily incorporate into each unit. People tend to prefer the private balconies. Speaking quickly to just touch on a few of the other items, your policies on the high-rise mixed-use, mid-rise mixed-use, and low-rise mixed-use, pages 52 through 57. Just want to consider the following. The max lot coverage of 90% possibly includes something along the lines unless can be shown to develop even greater area or with variance. There are some instances where you can develop more than 90% of a site and still achieve all the objectives of side yards, front yards, and fire separations. Where you state screening rooftop mechanical equipment, we just ask that you consider where visible from the street. There's no need to screen rooftop mechanical equipment if people can't view it from the streetscape. From the idea from adjacent buildings, etc., it's visible everywhere in this area. And to give you some understanding of what that cost is for the Village Junction, which we're building in Osborne Village, which the planning department was very good to work with, we didn't screen it in, and when we did that cost analysis, that saved us about $20,000 to $25,000 on a relatively small building. Much larger buildings, that mechanical equipment's much larger, and the cost goes up even higher. Where you state requirements for the base of the buildings for window coverage, we want to ask that you consider not just windows, but windows and a combination of a high-quality material, such as hardy or stone. We want to also ask for some flexibility on that percentage. Structure may impede that. Mechanical rooms may be found at grade. There might be some scenarios where you can't actually achieve that. Where you state traditional design elements from the area should be adhered to, I have a hard time understanding that one, and I wanted to put on record that, you know, some people do prefer contemporary design, and it can be found in the area. So for us, it was confusing. In summary, to wrap up quickly, we want you to review the concept of a focus group for a cross-section of the City of Winnipeg residents. We want the glazing requirements to be flexible. We want the screening of the mechanical equipment to be as required if visible from street. Those are all things that architects can easily demonstrate. We want you to create some flexibility insofar as stepping back. We don't believe it should be required past the first floor. I understand that someone may not necessarily agree with that statement, but we'd like some flexibility there. A chart, in our opinion, should be created outlining the shall, should, and may requirements for each policy in the development plan. I think that'll help reduce ambiguity, and it'll also actually ultimately speed up the process for the planning department and reduce their workload as well. Where you note 6 floors is noted as the maximum height, we want you to consider changing that to 8 floors. So that you can, at the very least, take advantage of the maximum height allowed for non-combustible construction within that class. We want some room for contemporary design because it's in the area, and we do have a sample demographic that live within the area or want to live in that area that do enjoy elements of contemporary design. It tends to get the best response from the young demographic that we're marketing to. Rooftop gardens, we're hoping, are only being suggested. We're asking that you review your policy to recess the balconies because, again, these balconies, that cost of that balcony becomes, it's twofold. It eats up indoor usable square footage, which is sellable square footage or livable square footage. They also tend to be enclosed at a later date, and I'm not sure how you'll control whether or not someone puts aftermarket, you know, glass enclosures in there for their sunroom. We want to ensure that everyone understands that flexibility is present in the plan. We think that the way it's written so far, it's great. We just want to make sure that certainty is addressed. This helps us identify a level playing field, helps us to ensure that everyone understands the must-do policies versus the flexible policies. I wanted to take the time to thank everyone for all the work that they put into it. Our voice has been heard in this process, and we've been included throughout it, and we do appreciate, as a business, as people that have investment, being included in the process. It's very important to us, and so we do appreciate that opportunity. That's all.
Thank you, Ross.
Thank you very much, and I was just going to say, we'll get the Curtis to go over a number of the things you've asked are incorporated in here,
sure,
in the amendments, but we'll get him to go over that. Thanks so much for that.
Thank you. Jonathan, would you like to come up?
Tim spoke for our group, for the most part, and covered the majority of my concerns. We do appreciate our group and on behalf of, I guess, other landholders, developers in the area, that our voices were heard. And I think just going forward, I would like to encourage that the planning department and council do some sort of cost analysis with respect to the design parameters and the design guidelines that they're putting forward, as some of these decisions seem to be made without having any knowledge of the costs and the impediments to designing these sites. So I think that's something that we feel really strongly about. I do have a question. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to ask a question, but
that's what you're for, yeah.
I think on page 11. Sorry, I don't have it. It was noted that during the initial 2011 and 2012 phase of the project, the plan area, extended westward to Harrow Street, and I'm wondering why that boundary was changed, and it's pretty important to us.
We'll get to all the questions. The questions go through you.
Go through me, but then we'll have the initiation reply back or whatever.
Yeah.
Right. Anybody else here for information that hasn't come up yet? Seeing none, going once, going twice, we'll bring the applicant back up. Okay, so.
I was trying to take some notes so I could.
I took pretty extensive notes too of all the questions. So
do you want to ask a question?
If you miss anything.
Yeah,
or
maybe
do you want
go
me
through your list.
Okay, I'll go through my
list.
Go through
follow-up.
Your list, and then
okay.
If you missed anything that I.
Okay.
I didn't miss.
The first speaker talked about building heights and flexibility. Certainly under the high-rise mixed-use area of the plan, the area sort of east of Pembina and along Donald, originally the consultant had come forward suggesting that we talk about building 30-story buildings along Pembina Highway, and we were really just at that point questioning how realistic that was, but there was never really any concern about heights of buildings in those areas. We totally agree. I think the quality of design is paramount, and I think we see that in design guideline recommendations, and hopefully we'll continue to see that if we develop design guidelines. In terms of the mid-rise area, now that's the area that's a transition between the high-rise and the single-family homes. Our feeling and that of the consultant was that once you're right up against or across a back lane from those detached dwellings, I think people do care a little bit about the height in terms of privacy, in terms of shadowing. So there, I think there'd be a little less flexibility about rezoning to 20 stories. But certainly in the high-rise area, there would be that flexibility. The next question I've got was... consultation on the review of the plan. That was Ms. Forsythe's question. Admittedly, the planning department hasn't done a lot of those in terms of reviewing our old plans, but it's always the expectation that we would do an extensive consultation with all the same stakeholder groups that were involved in the creation of the plan. there was a question about visitable housing related to that design recommendation about maintaining a floor level that's consistent with adjacent dwellings, and we kind of stumbled across that same issue. We certainly agree that there's a risk that that eliminates the opportunity to do visitable housing or accessible housing, and you'll see among your list of amendments today number L in the list of amendments. We're suggesting that that be tweaked a little bit. Obviously, the intent of the consultant was that there be generally consistency in the elements from one building to the next. We're suggesting instead that the wording be revised to say that facade elements, such as doors, windows, and roof lines, should be generally aligned with those elements on adjacent buildings. And in fact, in instances where accessibility determines the floor level, proportion and scale of facade elements should be consistent, not necessarily the floor level. So I think we've addressed that through that particular amendment. There was question about the idea of public parking at the backs of these commercial buildings and the idea of a walkway to connect to it. Much of what we heard through the consultation was that residents and stakeholders didn't want to see new parking lots up against the sidewalk in front of buildings. So really the only alternative other than interior parking is to put it at the back, and that seemed to be the lesser of two evils, was to have customer parking behind buildings with an ability to have a walkway that connects to the front. The idea wasn't to create large commercial parking lots along the back lane. Really what we're talking about is something no different than what you see along Cordon now. A lot of the banks and shops have a few customer parking spots at the back.
Curtis, I think that issue may have came from that idea that came up in some of the earlier consultations where there was a complete sort of transformation of the back lanes into something else, and that didn't go, that went over like a lead balloon with a lot of people, and we're not doing that, right? Like
that's correct. Yeah, you're right. The consultant originally floated that option.
That question came from.
That's right. That's right. So no, that idea is gone, and now we're strictly talking about the types of customer parking behind stores that you already see in the neighborhood. There was a question about the relaxation of parking on new development. Again, this is one that we picked up on in kind of a final review of the plan. And you'll see one of the amendments, item J in your list of amendments, deals with that particular question. What the intent was that where there's other strategies in place, such as shared parking or car share opportunity or a nursing home that doesn't require the same amount of parking, where there's strategies in place, that would be an opportunity to vary the parking requirements, not across the board in all cases. Parking and a payment in lieu was a term that comes out of the parking study that was done for this neighborhood. And what that refers to, and it's done in many cities in Canada, were as part of a variance, the applicant would have to pay into a fund that would be used only for the purpose of either developing public parking or other parking strategies, generally not general revenues. That, of course, would actually require us to amend the development procedures bylaw and possibly other bylaws. So it would be obviously a long-term thing for the city to explore, not something we'd be jumping into in the short term.
Does that also be used for something like car share or car share facilities?
I believe so. If we are writing the legislation, that could be written into it. Ms. Forthay spoke about sidewalk widths and cycling. On the first map that I showed, which is the pedestrians and circulation map, a number of bike routes are identified, and those come from our Active Transportation Advisory Committee. Their own recommendation was that the cyclists in the neighborhood generally prefer as commuter routes to use the adjacent streets, not Cordon itself, which has the buses and heavy traffic. So the idea of building bike lanes right on Cordon just didn't seem feasible and wasn't desired by the cycling community. I don't imagine sidewalks are going to be really widened on Cordon either way, so it might be a moot point, but that was our recommendation from the Access Advisory, or sorry, the Active Transportation Advisory Committee.
The plan does refer to the cycling routes on Pembina Highway.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Does it also refer to other enhancements on these side streets as well? Does it speak to I guess, I don't know if it gets more specific beyond what the plan already is for cycling there.
No, the consultant didn't develop any detailed cross-sections for these streets, especially the quieter residential streets. Generally, on a quieter residential street, you don't need to do a lot of unique enhancements because the cyclists are generally comfortable enough on those streets. It's the busier ones like Pembina Highway where you need to do a little more design work. And then on to, I think it was Mr. Cormack's list, one of the things he talked about was focus groups, looking at a cross-section, I guess, of consumers. Some focus group consultation was done as part of this project. It didn't focus necessarily on consumers specifically. It tended to focus on developers, builders, real estate professionals, as well, of course, as the neighborhood residents and business owners. He talked about the idea of creating a chart or a guide that that sort of lists out each of the requirements in the plan, which is probably actually an excellent idea. I might suggest that if the committee sees that as a desirable outcome, maybe that could be done as a separate motion rather than amending the plan. That could be a follow-up item for the public service to do. There was some discussion about a six-floor height limit, and I was just going to flip through because I think that had already been addressed in the final version of this plan. My understanding was that at least the illustrations show that buildings in the mid-rise area would be eight stories in height, not six. I'm just going to see if that's identified in here. Like I say, I had the illustration up a moment ago, and rather than hooking up the computer, the illustration of the mid-rise mixed-use area shows buildings in the 7 to 8 story range. So I think that concern has been addressed in the final version of the plan. The next question was about this idea of a setback on larger buildings at regular intervals. Again, this is one that we came across as we were testing this plan over the last number of months. And I think what the consultant was getting at was kind of the wedding cake approach where you step back and step back and step back. This probably isn't really realistic, nor is it actually reflected in some of the drawings that they did. Our recommendation in amendment number or letter I before you today suggests a rewording of that to eliminate that requirement. So instead it would state that the setback should start immediately above the second or third story, and the depth of the setback should be approximately equal to one story in height. And that's it, not intervals, one after another after another. The next question I had was about the issue of, I guess, views from new development into residential yards. Again, this is one that obviously will require some interpretation. I don't think anybody's expecting four stories of blank brick wall across the backs of these buildings facing the residential. But by the same token, I think some consideration, either through setback or step backs or screening or whatnot, would give some consideration and comfort to the residents who live adjacent to or across the back lane from Cordon and the other mixed-use areas. There was discussion about the green rooftops and sustainable construction policy in the plan. As I indicated, this is one of those should statements. It's certainly not something that's ever intended to be mandated for the entire plan area. If the word should give some discomfort to the committee, it could be encourage instead, may encourage. Again, not our intent to mandate that. We realize it's already costly and complex undertaking in our climate. This was a recommendation that came from the consultant, and in theory a good one, but sometimes there's challenges. Lot coverage in some areas targeted to 90%. That number comes out of the design guidelines section primarily, and as I mentioned in my presentation, the intent would actually be to kind of look at some of these things in more detail as we develop design guideline document. Certainly, there's some flexibility there. I think once you achieve your minimum yards, it might be hard-pressed to actually exceed 90%. It's quite a high number to begin with. But, yes, there's some flexibility built into that. Next question was rooftop equipment screening. that's a phrase that sort of is reflected in our zoning bylaw. And maybe one of my colleagues can identify how it's been interpreted. My understanding is that there has been some flexibility, and it's generally referred or interpreted as being viewed from the street. If the committee feels necessary to add the phrase viewed from the street as per the suggestion, we would have no concerns with that. And then the next question was about transparency. This one gives me some pause because I know we've struggled with some development. More historic, you know, during the 60s and 70s, it was a lot of buildings, and somebody showed an example earlier today of a project on Stradbrook that has 8-foot-high stucco walls with no transparency whatsoever. And I think that's created a lot of nervousness on the part of residents, and there's certainly a desire, especially on our commercial mixed-use streets like Cordon, that you have that transparency and that interaction between interior and exterior. Without kind of knowing what everybody thinks, I think the community generally is fairly protective of that aspect of this plan, and I'd be reluctant to see it disappear. Certainly, again, elements that are in the design guidelines are subject to further refinement with stakeholders, so there is that opportunity. Contemporary versus traditional design. Certainly, nobody's building 1920 buildings in 2015. That being said, the neighborhood has expressed a desire to see some elements of the traditional neighborhood, much of which was built 80 or 90 years ago, to see those reflected in some way in new development, whether it's in terms of the proportions of buildings, whether it's in terms of a particular roof pitch, the shape and size of certain windows. It's not intended to be a replication of a historical architecture type, but simply a reflection of some of those elements. And the last one on my list was the recessed balconies. This was a bit of an aesthetic consideration on the part of the consultant who wrote the plan. The feeling was that those recessed buildings on those upper stories creates a somewhat cleaner appearance for the street. I know sometimes there's concerns about a lot of junk gets stored in those patios and then see that replicated down a streetscape. It's sometimes not as clean and tidy a look as some might like. Certainly, I don't think the public service is necessarily married to that policy, and if this committee wanted to delete it, I don't think we would lose sleep over it. Have I missed any of the questions and comments?
Well, not just the last speaker, Jonathan, had asked about the Harrow section and also about the costing of the design parameters.
Oh, thanks. In terms of the costing, no, we certainly haven't tried to do an economic analysis of the design recommendations. As I mentioned, they are just recommendations at this stage. I am aware that another developer in this who works in this neighborhood has registered in support of this plan and has found that it has enough flexibility built into it that he can achieve construction in a viable way in this neighborhood. I think that's a bit of a vote of support in the plan. The boundary. My understanding was that there was an interest in aligning the plan boundary with the ward boundary to keep things simple and clean. Maybe one of the committee members can advise me if I'm wrong.
So just to clarify, there was two or three points there where you suggested minor amendments that could be tweaked here from what we heard tonight. You just mentioned one about the balconies, just to allow some flexibility there. Mm-hmm. The screening
the rooftop
of music
screening.
Boards as viewed from the street.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the roof gardens, just slightly softening that so it doesn't sound like everyone's expected to do a roof garden, because it is a challenge. I mean, I think encouraging it is probably adequate. Like, we do definitely want to encourage it.
Mm-hmm, sure.
So I don't want to. So if we could find some wording around those three minor points, I think that's all I'm going
to
need.
Yeah, would the committee's desire to be to delete the comment entirely about recessed balconies?
You could just delete, yeah.
Okay.
You could just delete.
And then amend the other two policies.
I think so. I mean, I think if somebody were to come forward with recessed balconies, it wouldn't be an issue, would it? I mean, it's not saying you can't do it.
Personally, I don't feel it is an issue.
Yeah, it's not really, it's just making it not the only way to do it. Yeah, okay. Sounds good.
Well, Cindy, do you have anything?
No,
questions?
Good.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
process station. Are we doing 8 and 9 together now?
Oh, I'm out of the state.
No, that's a separate hearing.
Okay, so we're just on 8. Okay, I guess we're ready to go. Is that correct? Go ahead, Councilor Jabassi.
I move that the report of the Winnipeg Public Service be taken as read.
All in favor? Opposed? Carried.
I move that the receipt of public representations be concluded.
All support. Opposed?